Hi, this is Martin Fowler, and you're listening to The Agile Uprising.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your host, Troy Lightfoot. And today, I have with me a very special guest, Blaine Boyton. Hello, Blaine.
Hi, Troy.
And today, we're going to be talking about business agility transformation. What does success look like? What are the challenges? How do we know? And just scaling back to an agile transformation, now the key buzzword is business agility. So what does that mean? What does it look like? Again, what does success look like? So that's what we're going to be talking about, going over some of Blaine's experiences. So let's see where it goes. So Blaine, if you don't mind, can you share a little bit of background about yourself and why we're on the podcast today?
Sure. I am presently leading the product management and marketing teams at GoGo. And GoGo is the in-flight internet provider. I've been with GoGo about 5 years and working in different levels of product management. I started as an aerospace guy, and so I was involved primarily with aerospace hardware and software, and through my my journey at GoGo, ended up with responsibility for the product team in general. So we look after all aspects of the passenger experience on board a GoGo flight, and most folks have had a GoGo experience. Some folks have had a polarizing one. We've worked hard to make sure that those are good experiences throughout the last couple of years as technology's changed and we've been able to provide a better and higher quality level of service to the flying public.
Well, thank you for that background, Blaine. That was helpful for the audience. So today we're going to be talking about business agility. So what does that mean to you? What is the word business agility and why? What was the tipping point for GoGo to go through some kind of agile or business agility transformation?
So Okay. Business agility at the highest level for us really means adapting to the changing needs of customers and markets. And ideally, you want to make those changes without paying a heavy price or incurring a lot of waste. So in a less agile environment, those changes are very painful. You mm-hmm. tend to work the plan because the plan is the plan, and that's what the most important thing is. And if the customer changes the requirements because of changing business conditions or whatever circumstance, I call it froth. There's a lot of froth associated with making that change. And so when we look at agility, we look at, can we make these pivots and can we do them in a way where we don't have a bunch of waste? Can we do them in a way where folks celebrate agility as avoiding wasted time and effort, as opposed to a more waterfall model of grumbling about a change in requirements and how that's gonna create more work. And if we would have only known up front, and you know, the reality is it's been proven it's impossible to know all this stuff up front. We think of agility as increasingly kind of embodying the validated learning framework, right? So you know what you can observe, what you can prove. Troy, you and I have talked about empiricism before. So we've started to think about agility as a series of experiments. The outcomes of those experiments inform the next thing that we do. Yeah. And so as we start to understand product market fit or how to commercialize a product or how to better serve customer needs, we have started to break down our delivery into increasingly small chunks. And we test those chunks in the market and we make sure that what we think or hypothesize about those chunks of value delivery is either true or not true. And then we adjust our strategy thereafter. The last thing that we think about is we have started to see what I call customer needs convergence, which means Yep. We have done enough experiments in our roadmap that we're starting to triangulate in on what the actual need of the market or the need of the customer is. And when we start to see more than one customer's needs converge into the same kind of superset of needs, then we know that we're getting things right. And so without taking an agile approach to that, you can't do the experiments. And if you experiment, it's very difficult to hone in on what the right path is.
No, that's a great answer. So for anyone who's curious about business agility, I think that's actually a great answer. So thank you, Blaine. Very well said. So full transparency, Blaine and I, he did mention we have worked together in the past for about a year or so. And so I had a lot of great experiences working with Blaine. So that's why I brought him onto the podcast, because I think he has a great story to tell. So there were some things related to business agility that, you know, we tried from, and I'm assuming you're still trying, from team level agile to program level to even portfolio level, right? And yeah, bringing in concepts of lean and everything like that. So what do you think, you pretty much just talked about what business agility is and what does success look like using empiricism for the business as part of what you just said. So initially going through this transformation, what were some of your early struggles?
Yeah, well, so you had asked previously about the tipping point. Let's talk about the tipping point a little bit.
Sure, sure.
We had a number of circumstances that changed in GoGo that really set us up to do the transformation. We had a new senior leader come in, and he is very familiar with the Scaled Agile framework. He's a big fan of it. He had implemented the Scaled Agile framework at our business aviation division, and so when John Wade came into CA, he, from the top down, said, we should look at doing a Scaled Agile transformation. And so, you know, many of us were very supportive of that. And having that top-down support was really the very first enabler that we had. Secondly, from a landscape perspective, we had more than 500 programs in our backlog. And they were all in some level of work in process, if you will. A lot of it was just cleanup that needed to happen that hadn't happened over the years. But when we pared it down, we still had, I think, just shy of 200 active projects that our teams were trying to undertake. So if nothing else, we needed to be able to see the forest through the trees. And it was really difficult with that much WIP sitting around. It was hard to know what to work on, what was important. Our delivery was inconsistent. So it's not that we didn't deliver, we delivered. But being predictable about delivery, that was tough. And knowing exactly what the right priority was or which project would deliver the most value, we didn't have those kind of structured means of prioritization. So you saw a lot of people doing a lot of work, but not necessarily the work that would move the needle for the business, because there really wasn't an objective way to understand which work would be the most impactful to move the business. We also had a fairly siloed landscape. The business was siloed in the way that we looked at marketing and product and engineering and software development. And so we wanted to bring these silos, kind of break the silos and bring people together. We wanted to align people around value. And we wanted to be able to answer the question, given all this work that we have, what is the most important stuff for us to do? What is the work that will allow us to move the needle for the business? And Scaled Agile gave us a toolkit in order to do that. And we learned a lot of techniques, and we're still learning a lot of techniques. But today, you know, the number of major initiatives that we undertake fits on one hand. And everybody from our CEO to each individual software developer understands the value related with the work we're undertaking, how the work that they're doing relates to an initiative, how that initiative is going to drive a strategic theme, and how the strategic theme is going to make a difference for the business. So we wanted to do better. We wanted to understand value, and we wanted to, frankly, improve our quality of life a little bit by reducing the amount of stuff we were working on. Those are the major tipping points.
Sure. So that's a great answer. So one of the advantages I would say that GoGo has when it comes to a leadership perspective is folks like yourself who have a background in lean. And I think that when you scale agile, the key, in my opinion, the key to scaling agile well at the program and portfolio level is that lean mindset and the lean thinking, right? Yep. So, and even taking some of those things at the team level as well. So I think we'll probably get into a little more of that in a bit. But what were some of the early struggles that you guys had when you were first going through this transformation?
So then I think one of the nice things about SAFe, as I said, is it gives you a toolkit and it gives you the recipe really for success. Mm-hmm. Some struggles that we had, we didn't follow the recipe.
Okay.
We followed parts of the recipe, but not some others. And so, you know, one of the early struggles we had was with the Scrum Master practice. Mm-hmm. We decided that we would ask technical leaders to be Scrum Masters. And
right. We
have a great, talented bunch of people. They agreed, some of them begrudgingly, some of them willingly. They gave it the old college try. But one of the big things that I've taken away from it is the Scrum Master job is a really tough job. And people in that position have to want to do it. They have to love doing it. And they have to be good coaches. They have to be an embodied servant leadership. And whether or not someone is technical doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to like being a Scrum Master. I think about some of my earlier days when I was a project manager. And so like in the early 2000s, there was this kind of path where, like, if you were a good engineer, then you automatically became a program manager as the next step. And that wasn't a good, those dots didn't always connect. It wasn't fulfilling. So having Scrum Masters that want to be Scrum Masters, that really enjoy coaching, that really enjoy leading a team in that servant leadership fashion. That's one of the biggest learnings that we had. Another one was around architecture. It's really hard to build the right stuff if it's not elaborated and made ready for folks to code. And so we didn't have a, you know, SAFe tells you need architects kind of at three levels. You need some folks at the team level, you need some folks at the program level, and you need folks at the portfolio level. We had a very kind of disjointed architecture landscape, and no one was really pulling together and making sure that the system worked as a whole. And so you had a lot of work that would start, but it couldn't be finished because the use cases weren't understood, or et cetera. The last item was around refinement, and we still work on this. And so, you know, I tell my folks, refine. It takes so much more work to make something truly ready than we ever imagined. And so, you know, we would write requirements and we would hold a review and it's good to go. And what you realize is that if you aren't doing some sort of structured method, we've implemented behavior-driven development that's been super helpful. If you're not doing something structured like that, I think it's almost impossible to have work that can be picked up that's portable because people don't have the context. They don't understand the use case. Maybe they don't understand the negative scenarios associated with it. That's the stuff that prevents you from being done, to be blunt. So Scrum Masters architecture and refinement, I would say those are the three kind of toolkit things. You have to have a foundation that you can scale on.
Right.
And we didn't have that. You have to have a build pipeline that works. You have to have a build pipeline that can do builds quickly. You have to have automated test frameworks that can give you a reasonable amount of test coverage to make sure that what you're building is going to work and doesn't have a bunch of defects in it. We had to go back and build that foundation after a few PIs. And so we're now entering our ninth PI, and our automation framework, we've at least now got all of our apps in the framework, and we've got tests running on all the apps, and now it's a coverage game. But we learned that the hard way. You know, that's taken a lot of effort, and it required us to put an initiative, an enabler around maturing the build pipeline and extending test coverage.
Right. So, okay. So thanks. 'Cause you just shared basically some of your struggles and some of the things that you did to overcome those struggles. So that was going to be my next question, but you already pretty much answered that. So thank you there. So I have a question. I just thought of it. So I'm kind of thinking on the fly now. So if you were to write yourself, because you said you're in your ninth PI now, The day before your first PI planning, if you can think about that, PI one, if you can write yourself a postcard now and send it back in the past to yourself, right? What would that postcard look like, or what would it say?
The postcard would say, don't skip the basics. Mm. Make sure you've got alignment, and make damn sure you've got a partner that's going to help you get it done. So I am very lucky at GoGo. I have a great partner named Peggy Shumway. Peggy joined and started leading our software development team sometime in the middle of PI 5 or 6. So I think it's been maybe about a year. And Peggy has been a great champion. She is she's a lean practitioner. She has really helped to make sure that there's alignment, and that the alignment is not only at the top level. So I've got great alignment with my boss. Peggy and I have great alignment as functional leaders in the business. But then making sure that your opinion leaders and your technical leaders and your product people understand the concepts, understand what agility is, understand what being lean is, what lean thinking is. These are the types of things that I would write to myself. It's so much more about the people. It's so much more about the coaching than it is about agile, or it is about how you write software. You need the tools. The tools are part of the toolkit, and there's different ways you can get stuff done. You got to figure out what works for your team. So, you know, for us, it's been showing our team different options. You know, if you want to go mob, go mob. If you want to do BDD, do BDD. You know, we give them the foundation. We let them choose what works for them. Sure. Those are the kind of the items that I would say. And never underestimate how much work it's going to be to make stuff truly ready.
Okay. That rings true to me. You know, even at the team level, teams that don't do refinement, you know, they get into their sprint planning, and there's so much work they have to do at the planning. Or if they skip it, then they have to do a lot of rework in the sprints, and it just happens. I see it all the time, and I can usually tell the effectiveness of a team early on if I'm just observing by their, if they're even having backlog refinements and how effective they are. And that scales up to the program level and then even to the portfolio level. So maybe you can talk about where you guys are at now versus where you first started, and what are the key things about that you would give some people advice about?
Yeah. So, you know, as we started to implement SAFE, we focused at the team level, and we needed to make sure that we had, you know, reasonable understanding of agile practices, and that the teams were using agile and scrum and some of the basic building blocks of the framework. And I would say that when it came time, I remember the first time that you asked us to think about elaborating epics, and I was scared to death. And we did a solid D-minus job of elaborating epics. What we really started to do, what made LPM work, was to pull together a cross-functional group of portfolio leaders. So our LPM is chaired by the head of our program management office. Mm-hmm. And myself, Peggy, who leads software development, and then my counterpart, Dave, who runs the commercial side of the business. We all come together and discuss at the beginning of the year, what are the macro strategic themes that are coming from the enterprise? Mm-hmm. And given those themes, what do we want to achieve? So we might focus on average revenue per aircraft, or we might focus on simplifying down certain parts of our software stack. You know, we find some sort of big initiatives there. And then we work with, we did actually a pretty interesting ideation session with across functional groups of leaders through product, software development, and the commercial side of the business. We ideated on initiatives and epics that would help achieve those themes. And we let our folks really suggest what they thought the initiatives were. And we came out with this great exercise we did at the end of last year. And then what we did is we took those epics and we put them into a backlog, and we started to refine those epics, just like our teams would provide features. And we took all those epics and we scored them using cost of delay. And we really spent a lot of time talking at the outcome level. Like, what's the strategy theme, and what's the outcome that we want? And then how could we get there? And we made that very visible. The Epic backlog is totally transparent. Anyone can see it. The cost of delay values are up there for everyone to see. And then we started stepping through and elaborating and refining those Epics based on their cost of delay. And and it worked.
Right. Can you share something, you know, since you started LPM, and you don't have to share any specifics, you know, company specifics, but maybe just a generic example, maybe, around putting something out like an MVP from an Epic. And when we say MVP in this term, we're actually talking about, in the true sense of MVP from the lean startup, about testing hypothesis, right? And using leading indicators and those types of things. So an example from LPM where you've actually measured performance of things, either an MVP performance or just overall business performance, and how that informs your work. So you talked about using an empirical method, and I think this is an example at a portfolio level that I think people could learn from potentially.
Yeah, I can give you an example, and our CEO has even talked about this in earnings calls. So, okay. it's easy to give specifics. A major initiative that we undertook in 2019 was to roll out Captive Portal. And Captive Portal is that browser that pops up in your phone when you join a coffee shop network that says, you know, coffee shop Wi-Fi is available. Do you want to join? And when you push join, it pops up and it says push here to accept the terms, and it pulls you onto the internet. Mm-hmm. Deploying Captive in the air was really hard. Because Captive supposes that your internet connection is constant and on, and Captive mm-hmm. is a bit of a gatekeeper and a bit of a tour guide, right?
Yeah.
Well, aircraft connectivity links are up and down. You know, sometimes we can't, if we don't have a satellite system on the plane, we can't provide connectivity at the gate, et cetera. So we really had to take an incremental approach to Captive, and we had to test. We had to test and understand, why is it hard to get on Gogo? And anyone that's flown historically knows that, you know, sometimes you try to type your homepage in and it won't redirect you. And, you know, you had to know this kind of cryptic address in order to be able to get to our splash page. A lot of that had to do with the fact that most people have a secure web page as their homepage, and we can't redirect a secure web page. It's not a thing that's it's good to do. So we had to first start by instrumenting the airborne experience, every step of the journey. We had to understand, are people having trouble getting on because they have their homepage set to a certain homepage? Are they having trouble getting an IP address? Is it a device-specific problem? So we did an initiative called First 15 Seconds. We wanted to fully understand the journey of the first 15 seconds. We wanted to understand a Pareto of reasons why people could not get connected. And that initiative informed our approach to Captive. Then we had to work with the device manufacturers, Apple and Android, basically to understand there are nuances in Captive. How Android does Captive is very different than how Apple does Captive. And so we had to take what we learned from the First 15 initiative. We had to then relate that to platform-specific Captive implementations. And then we had to build a Captive experience that would work whether you had an Android phone or an Apple phone, whether the link was connected or disconnected, whether you were on one of our air-to-ground aircraft or one of our new satellite-based 2KU aircraft. And if we had not taken that very incremental approach, and we went back to LPM at each step of the way, we said, you know, we know now the issue with people getting online, and we know that Captive is going to fix a big part of it. Captive made a huge difference for us. We hypothesized that if we could have a way to pull people onto the internet, it would help engagement and it would help conversion, and it did both. And so mm-hmm. we've got Captive deployed now on most of the fleet. If you've flown in the U.S., you've most certainly experienced it. And we did all of that Captive work based on a series of experiments over the course of 7 to 9 months. And what we built today works great. And it's a result of taking an incremental approach and learning as we went.
Great. So thank you for sharing that. That's great to hear. So I'm going to go back to something you said early on and talk about maybe my perspective as a coach, as a consultant. And we can talk about that. So You mentioned early that you had a lot of work in progress, but not a lot of value being delivered to the business. I'm summarizing something like that.
Yeah.
And that the focus, that the successes for you look like a reduction of WIP and figuring out what not to work on, right? Mm-hmm. Something like that. And that actually gets to, you know, one of the Agile principles about the art of maximizing the amount of work not done. And using an empirical process, even at a portfolio level, to do that. And so I think that is, that's fantastic. So I'll share a story. So when I first got there, one of the things I did was I wanted to visualize all your WIP across your pretty much all the teams at the company if I could. And there was really no easy way to do that. So I had to go around and manually track it, interview people, put an Excel sheet together. You probably remember that. And just to get a view of what is the actual WIP, you know, across, what is the WIP and also what are the cycle times and what is the throughput and all the flow metrics and all that. And I did that, and then we put together a program Kanban board, and we would sit around that thing every week for like 15 minutes as a large group. And we would look at the flow of work through the system. And what that Kanban board typically looked like was just a bunch of stuff on the left and almost nothing on the right, right? So that's fair to say. Okay. So one of the things that I started doing was, I remember it was around Thanksgiving. I found these little turkey stickers, and I tell this story all the time because it's just funny to me. For every month that a feature had started but not been in production, getting some business value, it got a turkey, a physical sticker. And you would see all these turkeys all over these. And I remember there was a product owner, I'm not going to mention his name, but there was a product owner who said, I'm not putting another effing turkey on a sticky again. And he was very adamant about that. So when he said that, I was like, wow, it's finally working. So I'm glad to hear from that moment, which was quite a while ago, to now the stories you're telling me about focusing in on reduction of WIP, focusing in on, you know, not building things that aren't necessary, cutting out the waste. I think this is a really great story. So I just wanted to share something from my perspective, kind of on the ground, a funny little story that focusing in on aging work and showing the WIP can be very powerful at any level. So, okay. So we talked about how far you guys have come related to agile transformations, related to business agility. So what's next? What's the next 12 to 18 months look like for improvement?
Yeah, so, you know, our major business objectives are really around driving the adoption and the desirability of in-flight Wi-Fi. And so Gogo has always been, you know, a somewhat necessary service for business people that fly. But getting everyone to use connectivity, that's our vision in the end, right? We know that folks are always connected on the ground, and we see no reason why folks shouldn't always be connected in the air. So from a business standpoint, my boss tells a story. He says, you know, when you, I live in Chicago, and he says, you get on the bus in Chicago, what is the engagement rate, or what's the take rate of connectivity on the bus? And it's always, you know, it's 100%. Everyone's got their phone up, and they're reading a Kindle or they're surfing Facebook or something like that. We believe that it should be no different in the air. So we got to figure out how to get connectivity to be accessible to everyone. And so that's going to drive a certain number of strategies and product priorities within our portfolio. From an agile and a safe standpoint, we are focused on two kind of intermediate milestones over the next 6 to 12 months. The first is realization of what we call independent teams. So we want teams to be able to take work, complete work, build and deploy work on their own. And that's not something that we have historically been set up for. So I talked about building the foundation. We're putting a lot of work into our build pipeline. We're putting a lot of work into automation. And we need teams to be able to take, complete, and deploy work on their own without a bunch of dependencies.
Right.
Then what we want is to build independent agile release trains. So we want the trains to be able to operate independent of each other and deliver value on their own. Our development team is split. We've got folks in Chicago and we have folks in Chennai, India. And, you know, as you know, Troy, from your time, our teams were commingled. And right. I think you told us don't do that. It's difficult from a quality of life standpoint when half of your team is on a 12 or 14 hour shift in time frame to make sure that you're upholding lean agile principles and having respect for people and their time and their quality of life, et cetera, when you have these shifted time frames. So we want to get to independent teams so teams can build and have a better quality of life. Then we want to get to independent arts so that our trains can deliver independent of each other. And we believe that we're really going to see velocity improve when both of those things happen. So we're already starting to see the foundation for the independent teams that's really been enabled by getting the way we build, making builds easier, things like that. And we know that it'll be even better when we get the trains to be independent.
Yeah, because I remember, you know, when we had that conversation a long time ago, one of the issues with the different time zones, particularly across the world time zones, is that you have a couple options, right? If you really truly work as a team, what's going to happen is you are going to have very small amount of time where people can overlap working together, right? Or the other option, which teams tend to go for, is work as two independent teams and then have a bunch of handoffs and go back and forth. And that creates a ton of waste and a ton of rework and a ton of long cycle times. So either way,
I think you remember when we value stream mapped our delivery early on?
Yes.
And all the handoffs. I mean, it looked like a bowl of spaghetti. So, sorry to interrupt you, but I certainly identify with the last part of what you were saying. I
did. Yeah. So basically those are the options. It's like, okay, either you barely have any time to work together or you have two separate teams, which is under the guise of one team, which is really two different teams, and they have a bunch of dependencies between each other. And neither option is really ideal or that effective. So I'm glad to see that that's where you guys are going. It sounds like you've made some changes and you're heading that way. So that's great. And I love what you said about the business and your vision for where GoGo should be in the future. It makes a lot of sense. So, you know, best of luck to you guys there. When I originally wrote this agenda, it was pre-COVID-19.
Yep.
And so maybe we can just talk real briefly about how the coronavirus has impacted GoGo and what are some of the things that you're trying, experimenting with to deal with that impact?
Yeah. So all you got to do is read the news to read a very sobering account of what COVID has done to the airline industry. It is probably the biggest business challenge that this industry has seen in the last 15 years. So, you know, a lot of things happened. We've been at home since March 26th and, we've been working 100% remote. Our delivery and our last PI was the highest it's ever been while folks were at home. So that's interesting, right? I couldn't be more proud of the way that the teams, have taken to the remote working. If we didn't have, I would say, good, solid, lean and agile habits that were starting to bloom before this happened, I think that it would have been a very different story. Folks have really come together. They've really focused on delivery. You know, right before we got the stay-at-home order here in Chicago, I sat down with my colleagues in software development and on the commercial side of the business. And we looked at that epic roadmap from LPM and we did a what if. We said, you know, what if we get sent home? What happens if this becomes a problem? What will it do to the business value of these epics that we have in the backlog? And we spent 2 hours that Friday afternoon and did a what if exercise that ended up being extremely useful because the very next Monday we were all sent home. And we were able to immediately understand the shift in business value associated with the new environment. We rolled those shifts through our cost of delay. We reprioritized the epic backlog as a result. To be very blunt, we have reduced the number of initiatives that we're undertaking. Mm-hmm. We have used this time to focus on delivering more deeply on a smaller number of outcomes. That's helped with certainly that increase in focus has helped the teams be more effective in the distributed working environment. We said publicly a couple of weeks ago that we've had our folks in furlough. GoGo furloughed about 600 of our employees. That's happening on a 2-week basis, and so we have a sprint on, sprint off cadence for the duration of the furloughs.
So you were able to do PI planning through that sprint on, sprint off process.
Yeah, we extended our innovation and planning sprint because this situation happened right at the tail end of our PI 8. Yeah. And next Tuesday, we go into PI 9 planning, and it's going to be 100% virtual.
Yeah.
We took the lessons learned. So the nice thing about having half of our development colleagues in Chennai is that those folks do virtual PI planning every time. So yeah. we're getting a bit of our own medicine now. And, we looked to our colleagues in Chennai and we asked them what works, what doesn't work. How do we make the distributed planning most useful? And so that's been a topic of every PI retrospective since we started. We've worked really hard on collaboration and making sure that people are accessible, that you have, live video conferencing means so people can talk to each other and ask questions. Etc. So we've adapted a lot of our practices. We have tried to keep constant our values and our mindset. We've tried to think about how we can achieve what we want using different procedures and different tools, and all of that has worked out well so far. So PI will be fun next week, and we're all looking forward to it. I have no doubt we'll be successful, but it'll be different, you know?
Yeah. For sure. So I've gone through all remote PI planning now. It's definitely a challenge. You kind of have to extend it a bit, how long it is sometimes. But it can be done, and you can get some great results from it. It just takes a lot of work. And the fact that you guys are now on your 9th PI, I think it'll go smooth. The reason for that is because of your prep work, your refinement. If you don't do the refinement, it becomes very difficult to be successful in those PI plannings, even in person. So it's remote, true. It just scales that. Yeah.
Yeah. We had a really cool thing happen about halfway through PIA. We had a couple of our software development leaders and a couple of our product leaders come together, and they said, we got to do better on definition already. Like, we got to make this work. We got to refine it more. We got to make it more doable. So the team took it upon themselves to go revise the DOR. They implemented additional refinement activities that were necessary in order to achieve feature readiness. Yeah. They rolled that through the teams. So, the reports now are that we are the best prepared we've ever been for a PI as a result of doing the additional refinement and architecture activities. That improvement was organic. It was a thing that the team did for themselves so they could have a better quality of life, so they could have better predictability, so they could build and deploy more easily. And so, that's a major win. I was really thrilled when I saw the team say, we can do better on DOR. And I probably looked like a jack-o'-lantern. And a shame. They did a fine job with it. I mean, it's really good what they've done.
Okay, so I have one last question for you, Blaine. Then, since you are a senior leader yourself, one of the audiences that is often, in my opinion, neglected on these podcasts are the senior leadership. There's a lot of focus on team and program level agile and techniques and tips for coaching and all these types of things. From a management perspective, and particularly for a senior leader, for someone that might be thinking about going through this type of transformation or that has started and is maybe struggling through it. Any advice you have for potentially your contemporaries there?
My advice would be, trust your team, make sure that they understand, I would say lean and agile principles at the macro level, give them guardrails, and then, I always ask my boss, am I giving you the optionality you want when we have a strategic discussion? Do you understand the different initiatives that we could undertake and how they're different and what they'll deliver to the business? And there have been times when he said yes, and there have been times when he said it's not clear. And so for us, it's a bit of an exercise in showing that you've got enough optionality in the business to be able to pivot where you need to be able to make progress, towards your strategic aims. And then, the last thing is remember that Agile is just a toolkit and they're just techniques. And there's no guarantee that if you pick up a sander that you're going to be good at woodworking. So, you've got to check and make sure that that folks understand the outcomes that you want, and then they've got enough of a toolkit there that they know how to use in order to be successful.
One thing you just said, which I want to point out, is that understanding the lean and agile principles at a macro level and knowledge is not the same thing as understanding. So I wanted to ask you, I think this is actually my last question. It's just a follow-up. How do you determine if your people that are working for you or your colleagues have that understanding and not just the knowledge, not that just they went through 2 days of training?
Yeah. I try to ask folks to, first of all, to read back, what is the outcome that we're after here? So take the technical, we are a very technical bunch. Right. Take the technical aside. Is it clear the outcome that we want? Is it clear the need that we're trying to fulfill? Is it clear why this is valuable to the business? And a lot of times I'll ask folks to articulate that back to me in their own words. So don't read me back a slide that you've seen. Tell me why you think it's important. There are also just certain coaching topics that we touch a lot. We touch WIP a lot. We touch flow a lot. I was lucky. I've told you this story. I was lucky enough to learn lean on a manufacturing floor. Well, I think lean on a manufacturing floor is really easy because when you go to a manufacturing cell and you have a lot of WIP, there's circuit boards stacked up to the ceiling. Well, that's really easy to see, In knowledge work, that's really hard to see, Systems to display knowledge work inventory are not the way of nature. Yeah. You have to build those systems. And and those systems are threatening sometimes because WIP gets this kind of, negative connotation. So, we've done a lot of coaching and we make sure that we touch some of these big concepts over and over again. Systems thinking is another big one that we talk about. I made my poor team watch a video on systems thinking versus reductionism. And it was, it wasn't in a software development context. And they were looking at me like, why are we watching this? And afterwards, a few of them came and said, okay, I get it. So we just keep coaching on certain of the lean agile principles that underlie the whole framework. And if you stay focused on those things, and if people understand those principles, then they can start to pick up and learn the tools themselves. And that's really when you have success.
Right. So I'll just say my last piece on this is so that's great advice for the leaders out there. For the coaches out there who kind of on the other side, whether you're consulting, whether you're internal coach, even the fact, I'll give you a little backstory real quick. When I did my assessment of the things that I thought needed to be focused on first, one of my main things was flow, right? And visualizing flow and kind of applying the theory of constraints. I didn't use these types of words at the time, but in my head, this is what was going on, right? So I said, okay, so that comes to my Excel sheet example of that's the first thing I started. So I remember one of my first meetings with you in your office, maybe my first, was I showed you, I said, well, these are the things that I'm thinking about. And it's basically all lean based, right? So I showed you this Excel sheet and all that. And you were just like, yeah, this sounds like a good idea. And you told me about your background in manufacturing and all that. And it was almost like, okay, from a coaching and consulting perspective, now this is a little behind baseball, Blaine. So I'm just going to tell you, partnering with someone that is senior in the company that has influence, that has authority, like getting someone to work together as a team is really, really critical for success from a coaching perspective. Without that, you're just going to be recommending things or coaching people, but without the influence, it's not going to matter. So I just want to say that from my perspective, it didn't matter what I was going to suggest. If we weren't aligned on that, I don't think it went very well. So I'm glad that you guys have continued to focus on WIP, focus on flow. It seems like you're having some success with it. And my last thing here is that I really think regardless of what scaling framework you're using, if you're not using a framework at all, focusing on applying lean principles. I know it's not the same as a manufacturing plant, but the principles are the same and you can apply them anywhere. And systemically it's important. So.
Yeah. And I think if you are a senior software development or product leader, and you are interested in making a transformation, if you have a lean expert somewhere on a manufacturing floor that understands how to value stream map, that understands flow, that understands the lean principles, as you said, go get that person to help you, or at least use them as a sounding board, because they have all the tools that you need in order to be successful. And they can help you take what they know how to do on the manufacturing floor and apply it to knowledge work, and it all works.
Right.
The tools are different, but the principles are 100% the same.
Couldn't agree more. So thank you for your time, Blaine. It was great to catch up again. Had a fun conversation. I'm glad to hear things are going well. And even though things might not be going well when it comes to obviously the state of the world and the state of the airline industry, it looks like you guys are really well prepared, and that you're focusing on reduction of work. I think is definitely going to pay off for you guys, in my opinion. So just wanted to say thanks again. And where can people reach you if they want to reach out to you? Is there LinkedIn, or is there some kind of platform people have questions for you?
Yeah. You can reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm happy to I'm a pretty open networker there, and I'm always happy to receive a question or, you know, help. If I can help anyone out, I'm interested in doing that. So please reach out and let me know. I've had a lot of folks help me in my career, and it's I've been lucky. So if I can give that back a little bit, I'm always happy to do it.
Same here. So thank you very much, Blaine.
Thanks, Troy. Happy to be here.